From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
A truce in the banana wars is in the works. 1 year after Hurricane Mitch, Central America still suffers, and the lost crew of the Phantom is remembered. And red stripe action gets underway in Jamaica. I'm Jessica Robertson, and this is BBC Caribbean Report. CARICOM's point man on bananas, Dominica Prime Minister Edison James, believes the European Union is close to proposing a banana arrangement, which will satisfy the World Trade Organization and key players in the trade. Mr. James says talks between the various parties concerned have led to hope that a tariff quota licensing system will receive the necessary support.
It will be accepted. That is the rule. If we all agree, the players agree, then that is acceptable under the WTO. And that is why it's important for us to get agreement, and that's why we are heartened that all the players have indicated and they're willing to go along with that. The Chiquitas do not want to see a tariff-only arrangement. The Ecuadorians do not want to see a tariff-only arrangement because in that situation they would lose out.
Under the first phase of the proposal, the licensing system, 800 tons of Caribbean bananas would enter the EU market without any tariffs. Beyond that figure, regional fruit would be subjected to a specific tariff and quota. Prime Minister James says the US may not publicly support the arrangement, but he expects that they will not challenge it in the end.
I don't know that anything will make them say yes. I suspect it will have to be that the European Commission will put forward a proposal and they may not challenge it to the extent that they do not want to go public with disagreeing with something that they've agreed with us privately. But the sense I get is that they feel it is for the European Union to put forward a proposal with respect to the modification of the regime. And on the other hand, the European Union, as I indicated, does not want to run the risk of putting something forward which the Americans are likely to challenge. But in the discussions we've been having with them, we've indicated to them where we are with the Americans. They themselves have been having discussions with the Americans.
Dominica Prime Minister Edison James. The CARICOM heads at their seventh special summit in Chaguaramas, Trinidad, have been locked in an all-day session. They've been discussing a new vision for the 26-year-old regional common market and community. Tony Fraser reports from the conference center.
At the opening session yesterday, CARICOM Chairman Prime Minister Basdeo Pandey urged his colleagues to finish the business of the 20th century and set a new agenda for the 21st. From sources inside the meeting, I have learnt that the new vision focuses on transforming the CARICOM Secretariat into a more dynamic institution with added authority to implement decisions taken by the heads of government. But the discussion has also been examining ways to bring dynamic and radical change to the structure of the heads of government meetings and the various ministerial councils. Leaving the discussions early to catch a plane, Prime Minister P.J. Patterson would only hint at the nature of the discussions.
We have agreed on a program of action. We have agreed on the things that we need to concentrate on in order to improve greater effectiveness in the implementation process.
Sources told BBC Caribbean Report that countries such as Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica want CARICOM to be restructured to allow member states to engage in bilateral trade and economic relations with third countries. However, the qualification is that those external relations must not impact negatively on CARICOM members. The leaders also had before them today proposals for a major cricket conference. The internal politics of Guyana, through a report from St. Lucia's Prime Minister Kenny Anthony, was another item for discussion. German Prime Minister Basdeo Pandey is expected to address a news conference late Wednesday. Tony Fraser, the CARICOM summit at Chaguaramas for BBC Caribbean Report.
A Commonwealth delegation to Pakistan has warned that lack of a clear timetable for a return to democracy could mean that country's suspension from the organization. Delegation leader, Canadian Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy, has said the team would recommend suspension if the regime fails to give a firm commitment to restoring democracy. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones reports.
Speaking to reporters as he flew to Islamabad, Lloyd Axworthy said that the Commonwealth foreign ministers are not just note-takers. We are not only on a fact-finding mission, he said, but we will also be starting a dialogue. Earlier, Mr. Axworthy made it clear that the Commonwealth is looking for a firm commitment from the Pakistani military to restore democracy, failing which the country could be suspended from the organization. The Commonwealth delegation will be in Pakistan for under 48 hours. During that time, the foreign ministers will be seeing a number of political leaders, as well as the new chief executive, General Pervez Musharraf. Western diplomats say they have requested a meeting with the ousted Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, but it's not yet clear whether that will happen. Mr. Sharif remains in detention and has not been able to make any public statements since the coup. Whilst the American government has indicated that it is willing to work with the new regime in Pakistan, the Commonwealth has taken a harder line and has already suspended Pakistani officials from attending Commonwealth meetings. Under Commonwealth rules, that was automatic as soon as the coup took place. Full suspension, however, is not automatic and will depend on the outcome of a Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Durban next month.
That was the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. A year after Hurricane Mitch killed more than 15,000 and left a million more homeless, the pain and suffering in Central America is far from over. Crime rates and domestic violence have escalated, and more people are being driven from their homes in search of a place to live or work. Non-government organizations continue to try and ease the problems, but Malcolm Rogers, senior policy officer at Christian Aid, says there are obstacles. I spoke with Mr. Rogers from our London studio earlier today and asked him if Honduras's poor really were dealt the hardest blow.
I think that's indisputable. And what is a year on deeply concerning is that many of these poor people have not received the help that they need. 1 year on, there are thousands of people who are still living with friends or relatives because they don't have a very small amount of money to rebuild essentially what is a shack of one kind or another in a shanty town area or in a deeply vulnerable part of the countryside.
Tell me about how aid has been distributed over the last year.
The international community pledged over $2.5 billion to Honduras. A lot of that money has not yet arrived in Central American countries, and certainly not in Honduras. Much of it has been tied up. There are other funds which seem to be on hold at the moment because the government of Honduras is not able to give donor nations the reassurances that it requires for transparency.
So basically what you're saying is the fault lies with the national disbursement and claiming system as opposed to with the donors. If this is the case, how do you convince the wider public to continue giving money if you're seeing now a year later that the people who need it aren't getting it?
I think the fault probably lies with both in that sense. I think the international community is not acting fast enough to implement programs with the government of Honduras. The message that we pick up from that situation after, 1 year on from Mitch, is that natural disasters have long-term and very deep effects that we don't always register immediately and quickly.
Malcolm Rogers of Christian Aid. A memorial service was held today in quarantine Guyana to mark a year since the cruise ship MV Phantom was lost at sea. 31 crew members were killed, none of their bodies recovered. Parent company Windjammer today presented some of the victims' families with a chain and locket inscribed with biblical scripture. One of the missing crewmen was 38-year-old Jerry King from New Amsterdam in Guyana. Debbie Ransom spoke to his sister, Dawn King, and asked her how the family is coping 1 year on.
His eldest daughter, she's writing an examination right now, the cabin examination, and she's old enough, she understands. But she still figures that, you know, she dreams and says that, well, her dad is still alive. The other guy is the one who, his son, which is like 15 years old, he is a bit shocked because he still gets up at the night and worried that, well, oh, daddy came last night. That's, you know, he always dreamed that his father came and tell him something, you know. And the other two are very small. When my brother died, the third one was like about 2 years old. And the other one was 3 months old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of the people on the Phantom had come from the same area. Did you get a lot of support from local people?
100%. When this thing actually happened, we had to get someone to answer our telephone because it was ringing from 6 in the morning to midnight. The community is probably about 10,000, but people know each other. Everybody knows somebody and some, you know, so we had wonderful support from everyone.
A year later, and there's a lot more in the media, it's everywhere, the first anniversary of Hurricane Mitch. Do you find that it's helping you to deal with it, or it's just making it worse?
I can probably say it's both, because we knew this day is coming. We knew that, you know, and I was trying my best for no one to call my mom and like say, I hope, you know, people will come to say, well, you know, give you kind words. But I'm hoping that no one calls my mom because my mother suffers from asthma and it only makes her condition worse. And me personally, I am trying my best to keep that. My dad has a heart condition, which only makes it, you know, we just don't want to remember much of it. But then I know my brother would want us to remember him in a very good, you know, and that's what we, you know, we will do what we have to do, you know.
Dawn King ending that report by Debbie Ransom. In Kingston, Jamaica, a commission of inquiry into the escape of 23 maximum security prisoners entered its sixth day. This comes at a time when violent crime and the fear that comes with it is at an all-time high in the capital city. Karen Weir reports from Kingston.
The 23 fugitives fled from the downtown Kingston Penitentiary, one of only three maximum security institutions on the island, between 11:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on the morning of Friday the 8th of October. Although two escapees have been shot and killed and five recaptured and imprisoned, 15 of the 23 original runaways remain at large. The commission of inquiry began at the Jamaican government's National Security and Justice Office in Kingston on Thursday, October 21st, into how these 23 maximum security prisoners jointly escaped from the Tower Street Adult Correctional Centre. The public inquiry aims to clarify how exactly the breakout occurred. Rumours abound as to the method the jailbreakers used to escape. They range from through a drain large enough to admit an adult to the use of ropes and planks of wood to scale the prison's walls. What is in no doubt is the embarrassment now being felt by the Tower Street Centre's senior managers as they reveal a catalogue of security breaches at the inquiry. This includes revelations of inmates having access to old warders' uniforms, the unavailability of workable two-way radios to communicate within the prison, and prisoners being sent and accompanied between various points on the prison's compound. The Commission of Inquiry is scheduled to conclude sometime in the middle of next month once 59 members of the prison staff have been interviewed. By this time, it's hoped the full facts as to how and why this mass jailbreak occurred will be brought to light. In Kingston, Jamaica, this is Karen Weir for BBC Caribbean Report.
Jamaica and Bermuda kicked off the Red Stripe Bowl one-day cricket competition today in St. Catherine in Jamaica. It's also the 20th season in first-class cricket for the Jamaican captain, Courtney Walsh. As he continues to chase the record as the greatest wicket-taker of all time, some in the Caribbean are asking how long he can continue. More in this report, but from Oren Gordon.
When the 37-year-old Courtney Walsh marked out his run in the small ground in Jamaica's aluminium mining country, he was doing something he'd done regularly on the regional stage for two decades. Walsh is something of a wonder in the cricketing world. It was the old enemy, the former England captain Michael Atherton, who made the point in Walsh's recent biography that he was part of the West Indies domination until about the mid-90s, and according to Atherton, has been like a rock in the more turbulent period since. He'll keep going because he's just 12 wickets short of Kapil Dev's record of 434. But some in the Caribbean are wondering just how much longer. The cricketing journalist and commentator Tony Kozia.
He just seems to be like one of those clockwork toys. You just wind them up and he keeps on going. But there is a question being more frequently raised here in the Caribbean now as to how far and how long can the West Indies, or should the West Indies selectors, continue with both Ambrose and Walsh. There are a number of young fast bowlers who it is felt are being held back by not being given the responsibility of using the new ball, of taking the lead in the attack.
Walsh's Jamaicans are many people's favorites, despite the injury to and loss of Jimmy Adams. They've supplied most of the recent new recruits to the West Indies batting lineup: Wavell Hines, Chris Gayle, and Ricky Powell.
Oren Gording ending this edition of BBC Caribbean Report. I'm Jessica Robertson saying goodbye from London.